Blue Jays are. As Bichette cranks another one. Deep left center. It's gone! A three home run game for Bo Bichette. Man, oh man.
Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters, brought to you by Miller Lite, the original light beer. Today is Thursday, September 8th. Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith, our producers, are Luis Ramirez and Christian Ryan. Ben, I quite literally minutes ago got back from Baltimore, where the Blue Jays played four games in 3 days against the Orioles, and each game was like its own soap opera novella. Like, there was so much going on in each one, and there were like a million different little storylines and character arcs and it just plot lines transpiring. I know you were watching from here in Toronto. What was kind of your favorite of all the plot lines and all the storylines that we saw in Baltimore? Which one did you enjoy the most?
Oh, there's some good ones. There's some really good ones. I gotta go Brian Baker. You think about Jeff Nelson, of course, but I don't like it when umpires become big characters, and I don't want to feed into that, so I'm just going to set that aside. But Brian Baker, there was a lot going on there. That was some pretty entertaining stuff from Brian Baker as he interacted with Teoscar Hernandez and the whole Blue Jays dugout. And this is a guy with some history with this organization. And really, to me, the Baker episode, which you obviously were witnessing firsthand and talking to the players about afterwards, but it just underscores, hey, like, these games matter a lot, not only to the Blue Jays, but to the Orioles. And we're at that point in the season where things are really getting interesting. So, yeah, I would pick the Baker one out of everything.
So we could start with the Baker thing. But like, I would say mine, honestly, was as reticent as I am to let Jeff Nelson be any more of a character in this than he very clearly wants to be himself. I did think the Gausman Nelson thing was actually probably the most interesting one, just because it was so ridiculous on so many different levels. But like, let's start with Brian Baker v. Teoscar Hernandez / the entire Toronto Blue Jays dugout. And like, as I sort of learned more about it and talked to more people about it and kind of dug into the history a bit more, it sort of crystallized what we saw in the moment. Because in the moment, it was like, you almost, if you weren't really, really watching Baker in the moment, you wouldn't have even seen the gesture towards the dugout. But the way the Blue Jays just all erupted onto the field, it wasn't like just one guy, or it wasn't, it didn't kind of simmer for a little bit. It was literally like every dude in that dugout is on the field in an instant.
And a swing and a miss. Chapman strikes out. The Blue Jays get a run, but still trail by a run. Seventh inning stretch. And now, wait a minute. Now the dugouts are clearing. And it looks like it has something to do with Baker. And is it Teoscar Hernandez being held back? This is a guy who was in the Blue Jay organization for a couple of years, made one appearance, and Teoscar is heated.
It should have dawned on me at the time, oh, there's a history here. Like, oh, there's got to be like something that's been going on here, because the reaction was just so immediate and loud and visceral that it was like, of course it wasn't just over Baker just looking in the dugout once or just making a motion once. And that, like, by now everybody with a Twitter account has seen like the history that Chris Black, Sportsnet producer, went through and dug up with Baker and the Blue Jays. And that's some of what I was hearing like in the clubhouse and from the people I was talking to with the Jays, just about like how long this has been simmering. It's funny, some of these little things that happen in a game that you don't even notice, right, that are sort of imperceptible unless you are like absolutely like razor locked in, or unless for some reason and you would have gone to a Blue Jay, and I don't know why you would have, to be like, hey, what do you think of Brian Baker? But like, this was something that built over time. For one reason or another, Brian Baker has been like taking little shots at the Blue Jays and having little remarks and little celebrations for a while every time he pitches against them, whether he gives up runs or not, apparently, which is what I heard from, more than a few people in the clubhouse, was like, dude, you gave up runs on back-to-back days. And like, Teoscar took you really, really deep. Like, I don't know if that's the spot to be doing that sort of stuff, but it is a cool reminder of just like how much is happening on a baseball diamond and how much of it we don't even really notice in the moment.
Exactly, especially this time of year, where you've had some time for these things to build, and these intra-division games, right, where the balanced schedule might take away some of this, but the Jays and Orioles have seen a lot of each other, and they will continue to see a lot of each other in the next few weeks as the regular season comes to a close here. But Baker, of course, someone who was in the Blue Jays system, acquired from the Rockies in the Sangwon Oh trade a few years back, and he was briefly in the system for the Blue Jays, pitched, I want to say, one game for them in 2021. And, you know, so he's been around. Yeah, he was on the team for a week. He's been around at spring trainings. Never a prominent Blue Jay by any stretch. And even now, I mean, look, he's in the major leagues. That's not easy to do. He's throwing 100 miles an hour. That's obviously not easy to do. He's an okay reliever on an okay team. You know, he's not Mariano Rivera. He's not Josh Hader out there. He's not even Felix Bautista. Now, that being said, if he's going to celebrate in a way that is just for himself and he's just going to enjoy a big moment like a strikeout, I have no problem with that whatsoever. Of course, once you start getting to the point that, you know, he's making some pretty rude gestures and, you know, if you're getting into a fight with Teoscar Hernandez too, like Arden, you and I have been around Teoscar Hernandez for years now. He's, to the extent that we can see these things, he is a very chill individual. He's someone who almost always has a smile on his face. He's not an easy guy to get into a fight with. Like, you don't see media members in fights with Teoscar Hernandez. You don't see players. Like, he's just a pretty chill individual as far as we can tell. That obviously comes across in the dugout and in interviews. He's got a big smile on his face a lot of the time. And Brian Baker's getting in a fight with Teoscar. Like, probably says something about Brian Baker. But, you know, maybe there's more to come on that front as well. We'll see.
Teoscar, super amenable guy. Like, just very chill, down to earth, friendly, easygoing. Just like everyday, consistent, sort of the same, just energy. Not somebody that you would have figured would be in the middle of that confrontation, which should have been a tell as well. And it's funny, like, it's not just me. It's even, I was talking to somebody on the Blue Jays who, you know, hasn't been a Blue Jay all season. And I mean, he, you know, it's like everybody's coming out of the dugout. Okay, off we go. We're on the field now and everything's really intense. And even he was saying, like, what? Why are we out here? Like, what's like, wait, yeah. Wait, why is everybody so mad at Brian Baker? And it had to be like explained to him the history of it, right? And just like the little gestures and the looks and the commentary that has been transpiring throughout the season from Baker towards the Blue Jays. And then I had another Blue Jays player kind of tell me, like, it's ridiculous because we didn't DFA him, as in like we, the players, like nobody in the dugout makes roster decisions. None of us, like, none of us didn't give him an opportunity when I guess he felt like he deserved it. None of us cast him away from the organization. Like, we don't make those decisions. We're all just playing baseball. Why are you mad at us? Like, why are you directing that towards us? We had no say in any of this. And if anything, you ended up going to Baltimore where you did get an opportunity and got to be a big leaguer and got to pitch at the major league level. And now you're a reliever on like a team that's battling for a postseason spot. You've been earning big league service for a long time and big league pay and all those good things. You weren't getting that opportunity in Toronto. It was a good thing that Toronto let you go. So I do think there are some people with Blue Jays who just think like that's just how the guy motivates himself, right? Like that's just where he kind of gets his competitive fire from, and that's how he kind of gets himself up for big moments. And sure, I guess, but like it's even funny to hear Teoscar Hernandez after the game, you know, telling me and Rash, like, I thought I was cool with that guy. Like, he was a Blue Jay last year. I thought we were cool. I wasn't talking. I've never said anything to him. I've never pimped a homer against him. I don't know what I did.
Yeah. And it's in such contrast to, like, let's pick Josh Donaldson, right? You know, he's someone who is chirping other players. And, you know, there were times when he would be the one making gestures or comments from the Blue Jays dugout. And at the time, all right, like, there's a case to be made. It's competitive. It's a competitive game. Any way that you're going to find an edge, that's okay. You can find it. Like Alek Manoah, who I'm sure we'll get to. I mean, he's someone who pitches inside. That's, to some extent, maybe it's an intimidation factor. But it's also something that enables him to have huge amounts of success against right-handed batters. And I don't think it's a coincidence. Alek Manoah, you know, you watch him warming up before games. He's always stretching into the opposite corner with the other pitchers warming up. And I always wonder, like, does that get on the other guy's nerves? Like, it kind of must. Then someone like Shohei Ohtani is, I'm sure, you know, too composed. And I don't want to say too polite, but just, you know, full of patience, it seems. And I don't think that he would necessarily say that to Manoah. But I don't know. There are times where Manoah can kind of push those things. And that works. That's part of the game. So I understand that for Baker. But I do think you cross a line when you start just making overtly rude gestures and picking fights with guys who are just, you know, playing the game, picking fights with Teoscar. I think that does cross the line a little bit, but it's certainly entertaining.
I forget who it is. I'm blanking on the guy, but there is a hitter with a team that Blue Jays play a lot who always stands off of the batter's box, like towards the backstop, sort of like within the pitcher's vision when he's delivering. And I'm blanking on who it is, and I don't want to name the wrong name. I think it's a Yankee. And it's little things like that, right? Like you mentioned, you know, Manoah warming up in the corner. Like, you know, some of those like little, sometimes you'll even see, I think Manoah's done it, a few guys have done it, like Blue Jays walking off kind of the field after their warm-up, the starter.
Yeah.
A little bit late.
Exactly. Exactly. Like that happens, and you'll notice like the pitcher will be almost getting ready to pitch.
Yeah.
And Manoah he doesn't mind doing this. Right? And I don't think that's a problem necessarily until someone calls you out, right? Like if you're going to take that space, that I think that's actually okay. Now, you could imagine a scenario where another team might take issue with it. But I find it really interesting. And even like, I want to see, we were in New York doing ATL stuff and they had the Paul O'Neill ceremony. Was Manoah starting that day? Yeah. I might be conflating things in my mind, but you know, there'll even be like this Yankeeography happening and he's just like, yeah, I'm going to do my thing. I'm going to get ready.
I love those little things, right? Like those, I'm going to take this little inch. And because it's so small, you're not going to say anything about it, but this is going to send a message to you that like, I'm that dude. Like, I'm a dog and I'm here to compete. Yeah. Like, I love that ultimate competitor stuff. Some of those little things that happen on the margins is like so interesting and fascinating to me. Can we talk about my favorite storyline, which was the balk, which wasn't a balk, but the called balk against Kevin Gausman by Jeff Nelson, which was like just the most ridiculous thing that every night there's some strike zone that's improperly adjudicated or somebody gets a quick trigger, like ejection, whatever. And everyone cries ump show. This was the, like one of the more egregious ump shows I think that I've seen because of the situation. You think about how important that game was. Game one of a doubleheader against the Baltimore Orioles. Blue Jays and Orioles entered that game. They're 2.5 games separating them at the time. Super, super important, tight game. Kevin Gausman allows his first base runner, and the very first pitch he throws with a base runner on, you are now going to put him in a zero out, runner on second situation in a tight game, a really important game in a playoff for his team, on a delivery that was the exact same as every delivery Kevin Gausman has used this year. 2,600 plus pitches, he has had the exact same delivery and not been called for a balk. And in fact, the very next pitch, look at my story, I put them side by side. The very next pitch with that runner on second is identical to the pitch prior and it is not called a balk. So either that is a balk or it is not. If you're going to call it a balk the first time, you have to call it a balk every single time after that, because it's your job as an umpire to enforce the rules. And you have now clearly indicated that this is a rule that you are going to enforce and something that you are watching for. So when the guy does an identical thing on the very next pitch, you have to call it. And Jeff Nelson didn't call it and didn't call it for the rest of the game. He just called it that once in that situation. I am not at all shocked that Kevin Gausman was irate and that he called out Jeff Nelson by name after the game. I think it's good that he did, because like that was just a horrific example to me of an umpire injecting himself, putting himself into a position or into a game, making it about himself in a way that it never should have been. If there was really an issue with Kevin Gausman's delivery, that message could have been delivered between innings during the foreign substance check. It could have been delivered to him before the game. There were so many junctures at which to say, hey, I'm going to need you to, you know, to make sure you're coming to a stop in your delivery, or else I am going to have to call this against you. That never happened. Jeff Nelson came into that game to make that call. It was premeditated and it put Kevin Gausman in a terrible position. I just thought it was bonkers.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. And, you know, it's one thing if there's a pitcher who's coming up and maybe his delivery, like remember Patrick Murphy and his delivery and,
yep.
you know, some of the changes that he had to make. All right. Like if you're calling box on him, this guy's basically a rookie in the league. Like, okay, that's part of it. You know, he's not established. The umpires don't necessarily know him. Every umpire knows who Kevin Gausman is. They know what his delivery is. You can offer like a polite reminder. And if he's, you know, if he's clearly breaking the rules after that, you've done your diligence. But, you know, what we saw here, I think, is also in contrast to, like, let's say, for example, egregious ball strike calls. And like, we're going to see more egregious ball strike calls as the games start to matter more. Those calls will be highlighted more. They will feel bigger. They will feel like they're more common. Of course, they happen all the time. They happen on May 21st when people are watching the Leafs, and they happen on July 5th when people are at the Cottage, and they'll happen in 2 weeks from now when the game feels like it has so much significance, and then we'll fixate on it. And I'm not a huge fan of fixating on ball strike calls because I just think they even out in the course of a season. But that being said, or even like the home plate rule, right? Like, people don't like that rule for the most part. There's an agreement that it needs to be changed. And I don't think Kirk did anything wrong on that play in Baltimore. But look, it's the rule. It's the way it's being called right now. You kind of move on from that. But Nelson, in contrast to that, with the balk call, really did insert himself into the situation. And it just, you know, I think I would say this even if it was Jordan Lyles or even if it was Garrett Cole. It's like, these guys are established pitchers. We don't need to be calling balk on them all the time. It doesn't make anyone's experience of the game better.
No, what are you trying to prove? Like, what's your point here? Like,
yeah.
Why are you doing this? Like, you know, because Kevin Gausman didn't change his delivery from that point forward. He kept delivering the ball the exact same way. So then what was even the point of that entire exercise? Like, what was that about? Something with Jeff Nelson, man. Like, he keeps popping up in these spots. It was the Oakland game earlier in the season when Chapman and Gurriel had like some pretty egregious strikes called against them on pitches that were off the plate, and you can look up the ump scorecard and how slanted towards Oakland it was in that game. Jeff Nelson behind the plate, game 6 of the 2015 ALCS. I don't need to remind anybody about that. Like, no, Pete Walker is like the only person even still like what in the organization who was there for that, right? Wow. Like, you know, really? When you think about
wow.
it,
that's right? A lot of turnover. Yeah.
You know, I mean, Mark Shapiro was just coming in essentially. Right. Yeah. So Tony LaCava would have been around, but it's like nobody in uniform other than Pete Walker.
Right. Yeah. You'd have front office and development people, but yeah, for in uniform. Yeah,
that's how far back we're going with the Jeff Nelson yeah. thing. And then it was a night later, John Schneider getting chucked by Nelson, you know, for arguing from the dugout. And Schneider, you know, told us after the game, I just asked if that ball was down. I just said, did you have that down? And Nelson chucked him out. And then, you know, Schneider got like every dollar of his money's worth after that. And I think unloaded like quite like a long buildup of grievances with Nelson that the Blue Jays have had. So there's just like so many little like subplots in this series that, yeah, you mentioned like the play at the plate, which ended up not being particularly consequential, I guess, in that game. But like, man, I think Alejandro Kirk did exactly what the Blue Jays would tell him to do. He set up in fair territory. He let the throw carry him into foul territory. I think, you know, maybe there was a little hesitation in the middle of his movement from fair territory to foul territory as he crossed the base path. Like, that's me looking for why that ruling and why that judgment was made the way that it was. Maybe there was a little bit of a stop there, but I feel like that is a rule that is going to come back around in the postseason at some point in somebody's series in a big spot. And that's going to be a major talking point at that point in time.
It absolutely will. Speaking of catchers, this just occurs to me quickly here. So Moreno was called up while you were there with the team in Baltimore. How long do you think his stay? Is he just here while Teoscar's on PAT leave? Or do you think that he's going to be here for longer? Obviously, he could come back later as well.
Yeah, that's my sense. I think that's what it is. The Blue Jays were like, we got enough outfielders as it is. Like, we got a lot of outfielders, you know, all over this clubhouse right now. So I think, they just kind of figured we'll bring up Moreno and you know, maybe we'll find a spot for him to pinch hit. I think it's just get some work in with the big league club, see how the, you know, pregame meetings unfold and what it's kind of like to be around a team at this time of year when everybody's super locked in and you're kind of in a postseason push. I don't think it's going to be a long-term stay for him.
Yeah.
Just like I don't think, you know, Mitch White being optioned what was it, on Wednesday now. He's got to stay unoptioned for 15 days, but he's going to pitch on Tuesday in that doubleheader. Yeah. He's going to come as the 29th. Man, the Blue Jays is so interesting. They're at this point in the season where they're in a postseason push and they need to win every game and they need to be like managing the bullpen in the way that John Schneider has been, where it's like Anthony Bass is coming in the fifth inning. You know, like it's, you're going to leverage guys a lot earlier. You're extending Jordan Romano to two innings. I mean, you are trying to set up your rotation so you're having as much Manoa against Orioles, Yankees, Orioles, Tampa, as much Gosman against those teams as well. That's the push. The pull is the schedule, is a second doubleheader in the span of 2 weeks, is the fact that the Blue Jays go to Texas this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then don't have an off day after that ahead of what is going to be 5 games in 4 days against the Rays, and then straight in to another weekend set. Like the Blue Jays are just having to cover innings right now, and like cover innings in like a May, June, July way. Like at that point in the season where you're like, yeah, we're going to throw a bullpen day. Yeah. You know, we had to option this guy. We didn't really want to, and call this other guy up because, like, you know, we're just kind of thinning the bullpen. We just got to get through this stretch. The Blue Jays are like covering innings and getting through this stretch at a point that they're in a playoff push. And it's not because they've mismanaged their rotation or mismanaged the innings that they're giving to their bullpen. It's because of the schedule. It's because of what it is. You're going to see the Blue Jays throw a bullpen day on Sunday. It's going to depend how things go Friday and Saturday. It's going to be Stripling and Gosman in those two games. They get a couple deep outings there and don't have to burn their bullpen too much. You're going to see another like Pittsburgh Pirates-esque from that game a week ago bullpen day, where it's like Trevor Richards for two, and here's Kikuchi for two, and now here's like four other dudes to get us to the finish line. And then you're going immediately into a huge series against the Rays. The schedule is not the Blue Jays' friend right now.
Yeah, and it's probably the last time that they're going to have to cover innings in this way. Once you get to that final stretch of the season, if they're doing really well, if they've established a seeding that they like, then maybe you can ease back a little bit. Maybe you give Kikuchi a full start, or maybe you roll with Mitch White. Obviously, it's getting ahead of things. On the other side, if you're getting toward the end of the year and you haven't secured anything, then you might be skipping those fifth starters. You might be bringing back a Gosman on a short rest if you really have to win game 161 or game 162. So again, we're getting ahead of ourselves either way with that discussion, but this is that stretch kind of in the middle of September where they do need to cover a lot of this. And to me, this is where, you know, to go back to the trade deadline, you see how, you know, Mitch White really hasn't done very much for this team. You see how, you know, Zach Pop has been optioned back and forth. He's been useful. You know, Whit Merrifield really has not impressed. And I think that most importantly, they're just an arm short for this period of time. And once you get to the playoffs, you roll with Gosman, Manoa, Stripling, Berríos. You've got a bullpen that has really pitched well in the course of the last 5-6 weeks. But one more arm for this period of time really would have helped them if they had been able to do that.
Yeah, you really only hit on Anthony Bass at the trade deadline, was it. And I think, you know, it's hard to kind of put like Zach Pop in a miss category. Like
neutral maybe.
Yeah, right. Like he's been, I think he's a good reliever. He's just been caught up in a couple of roster crunches, right? Because he's optionable. And the Blue Jays have a bunch of vets in their bullpen who you aren't going to option. And you got the pitcher limit this year, right? Like if this was a previous season and you had like the full 40 man up for September, yeah. I mean, we wouldn't even be having some of these conversations. Yeah.
But Moreno would not be on the team right now.
Because you have 28, you know, it's the Blue Jays are having to make some tough decisions and having to think about when they option guys. Like, you know, they're going to have to bring somebody back this week to perhaps make a start or provide some length out of the bullpen. And it can't be Casey Lawrence because he just optioned him. Unless you use him as the 29th man on, you know, the Tuesday doubleheader, but it's really my belief that Mitch White is going to be that 29th man on the Tuesday doubleheader. So now you don't even have the Casey Lawrence option unless he's replacing somebody who's injured. So now it's like Thomas Hatch, right? And we saw what happened the last time Thomas Hatch pitched at the major league level. He's been having some okay results at Buffalo, but the stuff did not play at the level. And that would be for games against the Tampa Bay Rays, who are really good, right? You're not throwing them against...
You're not throwing them against the Pirates, you know? Like, yeah. after the weekend set against the Rangers, it's really the last, like, really sort of lousy club that you're going to face. And they're not even that lousy offensively, right? Like, when you think about some of the bats that they're going to run out. I guess you got one more series against the Red Sox late in the season. We'll see what they look like then. But I know every series from here on out is going to be, like, the biggest series of the season. But I don't know, man, five games against the Rays next week, just with the schedule the way it is and the Blue Jays pitching staff the way it is. Five really big games. That is a huge series at Rogers Center.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you just think about any five-game series, anytime you're playing five games in 4 days, that's big. Then it's at home, you know, after a very long road trip that so far is actually going amazing. They're 6-1 on it as we record this on Thursday. So it's return home. It's five games in 4 days. But most importantly, division rival, right? Like, the Rays and the Yankees and the Jays are only separated by, what, six games, something like that, as we record this. And the Jays and Rays are neck and neck. So that's has implications for the AL East, as implications for the wild card, for seeding, for home field, for tiebreakers, for all these different things. So those games are very important. And hey, if you have to pitch Mitch White in a doubleheader, that's fine. I mean, teams, you know, have to cover those innings at a certain point. But I find that at this point in the season, they do seem to me like a team that could use one more arm. The one game they lost in Baltimore, that, you know, you have Kikuchi in leverage, you have Richards walking a couple guys, you have, you know, obviously Mitch White starting that game. It was a game where they were clearly short on pitching. And so it would be ideal to have a bit more. You know, they're not alone in that department. The Yankees obviously were very cavalier with their own pitching depth, trading away Jordan Montgomery, and that's a mistake by the Yankees as well. So the Jays aren't alone in this department, but I feel like they're one arm short at this point with 4 weeks left.
I know, and I asked around about that game a little bit as well, just the usage of Kikuchi in that spot, particularly after Anthony Bass had gotten four outs on seven pitches, even the usage of Trevor Richards later on that spot. And like, the answer was, look, we are thinking about today, but we're still in a spot where we're thinking about covering innings going forward and who's going to be available in coming days. Like, which is kind of like what I'm getting at, is that a team that's like in a postseason push in September shouldn't have to be making like innings covering decisions. If you messed up your rotation or you just don't have enough pitching depth, and yeah, maybe you can say that about the Blue Jays. If you screwed up your reliever usage, like, fine, you made that bed. But it's like the schedule made this bed for the Blue Jays. And the next baseball person I talk to who is happy about there being nine inning doubleheaders again will be the first person that I talk to.
Yeah.
Nobody other than people who like cash commissions off ad sales and commercial deals is happy about that. People wanted like the seven inning doubleheaders and wanted them to continue. I was watching Yankees Twins the other day. It was like game one of a doubleheader. They were in the 12th inning. I was like, what? This is game one of a doubleheader. What is happening? Teams shouldn't have to be like doing the innings covering thing in September. There should be an adjustment, I think, just either to the length of doubleheaders, to the way the games are scheduled, to the off days, to the roster limits, to the option limits in September. Like, I do think there should be adjustment made going forward for September with roster rules, just so teams can field their best lineups, can like use their best players and put the best product on the field, instead of having to be like, well, yeah, I mean, we'd like to extend Anthony Bass right now, but we kind of want him to be available tomorrow, and we also want to burn him out of like a really important series next week where we're going to play three times in 48 hours.
Yeah, and the doubleheader thing is, it's not even for gate receipts, right? Because you can sell tickets no matter how many innings the games are. It's not for beer sales or parking. It's truly for the broadcasters who want to be able to package those ad spots as they're used to doing. And it's a compressed season this year, so there are fewer off days per month than what you would normally see, because the year started on April, the, I don't know, 11th, something like that. It wasn't March 30th or March 31st the way it normally would be. So is there a March 31st?
I don't know.
That's not the point.
Use your something with your knuckles. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's what you're supposed to do.
We'll leave that for another day as the listeners of ETL scream at me through their headphones. But either way, the Jays are in a point now where they do have to strike that balance. And, you know, you look at, you know, 2 weeks from now, that equation will change and they will push for every single game that they have to.
And here's the thought process for the Blue Jays right now. It's, all right, let's get Manoah and Gausman into as many games of consequence as possible. So that is going to be Tampa Bay. Like, that's why you're going to have the bullpen day on Sunday in Texas. Because it's like, all right, if we have to use a fifth starter, and our fifth starter right now is our bullpen, we're going to do that against the Texas Rangers rather than against the Tampa Bay Rays next week. So you're going to have that bullpen day on Sunday, and then you're going to, you know, line up a Manoah against Tampa, which would allow him to come back against Baltimore the following weekend, come back against Tampa again at the Trop the weekend after that, when there's a four-game set in St. Pete, pitch early in that series, come back again for the much-anticipated rematch with the New York Yankees, you know, hashtag Audi sign, in Toronto the final week of September, and then Manoah would be available for that final series in Baltimore, those final three games. Same thing with Gausman. You're trying to line him up to pitch in those crucial series and to have your, like, quote-unquote fifth starter come up when you're playing the Rangers or when you're playing the Red Sox. So, like, that's how the Blue Jays have tried to line this up. The best laid plans go awry all the time, but they've charted out that way to get their best pitchers into the most meaningful games and try to put the soft spots of their rotation in the soft spots of the schedule.
Well, absolutely. And what they need to do, or what they'll have to do a few weeks from now, is ideally those last two games of the regular season don't matter, and you're able to pitch Mitch White and Yusei Kikuchi and line everyone else up. Because the last thing you want to do is burn Kevin Gausman and Alek Manoah in games 161 and games 162, and then you go Stripling, Barrios, and bullpen game. You don't want that. With your season on the line, you do not want that. And I'm sure, for, you know, if they were facing elimination in game three, a series is tied 1-1, they would have Gausman or Manoah back on short rest. No doubt about that. But you want to avoid that scenario. So you need to win as often as you possibly can right now to put yourself in a good position so that you have either home field or at least a playoff spot locked up. Who knows? Maybe the AL East is in play. One of those scenarios. And by the way, March 31st is a real date. I confirmed.
Confirmed. So,
I don't want to keep anyone in suspense.
We were all waiting for that update. You need to make that final series against Baltimore Camden Yards irrelevant. That's what mm-hmm. you need to do. You, like you said, you need to have Kikuchi, Lawrence, Hatch starting those games.
Yep.
And you need to have Bradley Zimmer playing like 21 innings, right? Like that, you know, that's what, and yep. you need to have, you know, just like George Springer resting and Vladdy off his feet and like all those things. Like you need to make sure those games do not mean anything for your postseason fate. Down the road, we could talk about, would you rather be the second seed? Would you rather be the third seed, right? Like, would you rather go to Seattle? Would you rather, you know, whatever? Would you rather go play the whoever the winner of the Central is going to be? If it's Minnesota, if it's Cleveland, if, look out, maybe it's the White Sox. We could talk about all that stuff down the line. But right now, the focus is don't have anything meaningful on the line in Baltimore on October 3rd, 4th, and 5th.
And that is a big ask, and I don't think they'll be able to do it. I think there's going to be a lot at stake in those games because it's so closely packed right now. I'm not sure if they can create the separation necessary to do that. So, you know, we'll see. But I think that has to be the goal, and it's, you know, the best case, as you said, is you have Thomas Hatch starting one of those games, and you look back, I'm sure a lot of our listeners remember 2015, game 162 against Baltimore, the lineup that they trotted out there, it was something to behold. It was not the Batista Eddie lineup, I can tell you that. So we'll see where it goes, but I think it'll be tough to avoid. We'll see where that leads.
I mean, as things stand right now, like if you were entering the final week of the season now, it would be irrelevant, but Baltimore's 4.5 games back, right? So you just got to keep Baltimore where they're at right now. And you're clear, you're good. And you've got three games in Toronto against Baltimore, a weekend from this weekend when you can knock them further back. The Orioles do have a lot of Red Sox on the schedule in September, I believe. So they might be able to kind of hang around for a while, but like, it's funny, we didn't even really talk about baseball and sort of looking back at the Orioles series, but like what the Blue Jays accomplished there and what Alek Manoah really, you know, made sure they accomplished in the final game of that series was winning 3 out of 4 and knocking Baltimore down and suppressing them and creating that separation that you're talking about.
It's huge. I mean, you think about how easily this could be different right now. You know, if they had gone 1-3 instead of 3-1, totally different discussion. So they did themselves some huge favors this week.
Let's step away, but when we come back, I want to take a little confidence check on some of the Blue Jays starters who, you know, are in the non-Manoah, non-Gausman class, and check in on a couple of hitters as well. All that and so much more when we continue on At the Letters. It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson Smith. Our producers are Christian Ryan and Luis Ramirez. And it is time now for Major League Beer for Major League Baseball, brought to you by Miller Lite, the original light beer. Ben, I'm actually going to have to recuse myself from this conversation because I'm going to have a vote this year for the American League MVP award. So I can't tip my hand and I can't let anybody know what I'm thinking, but like, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about the biggest debate in baseball right now, and that is Aaron Judge v. Shohei Ohtani for the American League MVP. So I'm not kind of just going to put you in an impossible position to be the only one to offer a take on this, but the floor is yours. Understanding that there are 4 weeks left in the season, which direction are you leaning?
What an incredibly tough call for you and the other voters to make. The times that I've voted for MVP, I think it's been easier. Like, I think there was a Betts year. I think there was maybe a couple Trouts in there. So, you know, sometimes it is clear cut. This year, it is, I think it's as hard a decision as it's been probably since Cabrera Trout, which in hindsight probably wasn't a hard decision. It was more just a close debate. But regardless, Ohtani is having an incredible offensive season that would get MVP votes on its own merit. He's also having a Cy Young type season that legitimately is one of the best pitching seasons in the American League, along with your Verlanders, McClanahan's, Dylan Cease, Manoah, obviously in that group as well. So it's incredible. And yet Aaron Judge with 55 home runs could easily set the American League all-time record. He could be one of the top home run hitters in an individual season of all time. First 60 homer season in 20 plus years, potentially. It's incredible what he's doing. And so I kind of wonder how this debate would be framed if they were on the same team, to kind of take the team element out of it. Like, if Judge was on the Angels still wouldn't be good. If Ohtani was on the Yankees, how would this be framed? I mean, I think they're close. War says they're close. I think the last 4 weeks will determine it. At this point, I would probably lean Judge over Ohtani by a little bit. But, and especially if he hits 60 plus home runs and sets an American League record, to me, it's going to be really hard to deny him. But Ohtani's doing things that are totally unprecedented as well. So it's really a win-win. These guys are both incredible. They're having amazing, amazing years. They deserve to be celebrated. And for baseball to be in a position where they have two seasons like this for the likes of yourself to be choosing from at year's end, it's a great, it's almost best case scenario for MLB to have these two stars having such amazing seasons.
My only prediction is it's going to be quite a debate and that there's going to be a lot of fallout from, you know, whoever does win it and how people vote. And there's going to be a lot of lawyering of like how you actually interpret what the award is meant to recognize. I almost feel like, and we can do a segment later on the season about how we would change the awards, you know, if we were kings of baseball, but like I would wonder if you should just call it the most outstanding player award, because it is almost hard to figure out an interpretation of valuable, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think that those debates have been had internally, you know, as you look for the best way to carry on these awards moving forward. I don't think MVP is going to change anytime soon. And the directions in there are just vague enough to allow for a lot of room for interpretation. Clearly, I mean, the good news is whoever wins this award out of those two, they're going to deserve it. Yep. You know, like, we're not going to have an undeserving winner, right? So we're not going to look back in years' time and say, wow, that was really a bit of a miss. Like, whoever wins this thing is having an incredible, incredible season.
Yes, no, absolutely. Like, you're not going to see somebody out of left field come in to win this thing. I think it's going to be one of those two individuals, and they will definitely deserve it. Let's do a quick confidence check on a bunch of guys on the Blue Jays roster that we just haven't had a chance to have a fulsome discussion about because there's been so much going on with this team, but they are going to be important to the club down the stretch. And I want to start with Jose Berríos, because the Blue Jays are sort of lining up their rotation down the stretch, prioritizing Alek Manoah and Kevin Gausman in games of importance. And now here's Jose Berríos with starts being pushed back to accommodate bullpen days. And he's kind of, he's not quite in the, like, you know, let's put the back end guys into the soft spots of the schedule category, but he's also not really a priority in how the Blue Jays are lining things up. What do you think that says about where Jose Berríos is at right now? And where's your confidence level in Jose Berríos right now? Who's going to have to start some really big, important games down the stretch, whether the Blue Jays like it or not?
He will have to, no doubt, and potentially in the playoffs as well. I guess to answer the first part, I think it almost makes sense to go bullpen game against Texas, an inferior team, and then start Berríos against the Rays where it matters more. I think that makes sense, and you get Berríos a bit more rest. Now, as for my confidence level in Berríos, it's pretty low. It's stayed low for a long time this year. It started high, and then it steadily declined, and I'd say it's kind of reached a low level where it's basically remained. I know his last few starts. Yeah, it has settled in at low. Yeah. And I know he's been better. You wrote about it, his last start, and pointed out, I think in that, I forget the number, but you know, his last four starts or something, he's been solid.
Wrote that the results have been better.
The results, the results.
I didn't write the process has been better. I actually wrote that the process hasn't been great.
And so that's what you care about the most, right? And so if the fastball is getting hammered, it's hard to have a lot of faith in it.
Yeah, and the fastball is getting hammered and the curveball isn't getting swing and miss and nothing's really getting swing and miss. It's really an issue. You look at the results from that outing at Camden Yards and it's like 6 innings, 2 earned runs. You take that all day long from Jose Berríos and from anybody in your rotation. But then you look deeper and it's like, oh, you missed 4 bats on the day and 3 of them were with your changeup and 1 was with a curveball. That's a problem. Jose Berríos needs to be in swing and miss with the curveball. And then you look at, oh, the fastball got absolutely hammered on the day and you gave up a ton of hard contact with it and hitters didn't seem fooled and they seemed able to tee off on your heater. And it's been the most perplexing thing all year is like why suddenly Jose Berríos's stuff, which seems to be in line characteristic wise with where it's been earlier in his career, hasn't been as effective and why hitters haven't seemed fooled. I was kind of subtle about it for a long time and then I stopped being subtle about it. I thought he was tipping for like a very long time earlier this year. And then you saw that little mechanical tweak where you move the glove up in front of kind of the chin and you flare out the glove so that hitters can't see when and how he's manipulating the ball. And he's had tipping issues earlier in his career as well. That's why he wears a mouth guard so that he can bite down on it during his delivery. And there isn't a tell with his mouth in his delivery, which is something that he had earlier in his career. Hasn't seemed to solve things. The results have been better, but as we're saying, the process just hasn't been there. So I'm with you. The confidence level just isn't super high in him. I need to see him missing bats. I need to see his fastball performing better. And I need to see some better tunneling of the fastball and the breaking stuff and some better lane usage for Berríos before I'm really going to trust him in a big way.
Yeah, exactly. And look, I mean, if we're talking about 2023, which we're not, they're in the stretch run of a playoff drive here. But if we're talking about 2023, he is on the list of pitchers, and there are others that we'll get to in this segment. He's on the list of pitchers where you say, you know what? I think actually he can probably help this team next year to some degree. But right now, that confidence level is pretty low.
Mitch White, confidence level for you. And this is one where both process and results don't look great lately.
Yeah, low. Again, low. He's looking like someone who's, a low leverage mop up reliever in the games that count most from this point on. Of course, there could be spots where he has to start. Maybe the doubleheader is one of them. Maybe there are more starts after that. But really, you know, when you're playing the games at the end of the season that matter most, regular season, playoffs, he's pitching low leverage. It's mop up. I don't think there's anything more. And I know like his FIP or his XFIP, those numbers are like half his ERA right now. So the advanced stats would say he's been a little unlucky. And no doubt he has. But he's still not striking a ton of hitters out. The walks are still a little bit high. And it's not just the walks. It's how he gets there. You know, we saw facing the bottom of the Orioles lineup, whenever that was, Tuesday, Wednesday, at some point this week when he was pitching. And he's not attacking them aggressively enough. Not using the fastball against those hitters, the 8-9 hitters, when he's got to put them away. And so we saw that against the Guardians here in Toronto through 6 consecutive balls. Again, I think he'll be good in 2023 and can help this team. It's a nice long-term acquisition. Short-term, I'm not sure how much he's done for this team.
Yeah, I like Mitch White for 2023. I like Mitch White with a spring in the pitching lab and working with the Blue Jays developers and some of the things they want to do with him, some of the tweaks they want to make, want to use that changeup a lot more, want the, you know, to really hone in on that sort of back foot slider to lefties, which you've seen him using a bit here now. Yeah, you raise a really good point, is that in that third inning when it was like, you know, Odor and whoever else is at the bottom of Baltimore's Oriole, you know, Mateo yeah, or like, yeah. Who, you know, Austin Hayes, it was, I'm in a two strike count and now I'm flipping up a bunch of spin and a bunch of sliders, and hitters are just getting into that defense mindset and they're sitting on the spin and they're fouling off. And now, you know, I was 1-2 after three or four pitches, and now I'm looking at like eighth pitch and ninth pitch, and now I missed with one, and now it's a full count, and he's not going to his fastball in those spots. And I think it's really hard to trust your fastball on the plate. Mitch White throws sort of hard. I mean, 94, you can get up to 95, but still, like, if you're not throwing 98, 99, if you're just going to throw 94, 95 on the plate, it does take a bit of a leap of faith, right? Like, it does, you know, I think for a lot of pitchers, they struggle with that, but it's also part of what makes like really good pitchers really good, is they realize, I'm the pitcher, I inherently have an advantage, and my fastball inherently is at an advantage against big league hitters. You still have to hit a round object with a round implement and make good contact and avoid the fielders that have been positioned optimally behind me. So you need Mitch White in those two strike counts to be trusting his fastball or to be locating a slider on the plate for strikes. Too many sliders, you know, in those two strike counts were like ball to ball or edge to ball. Like, you need to land that slider on the plate for strikes. Do what Alek Manoah does. Get weak contact. Do what Kevin Gausman does. Kevin Gausman's fastball is on the plate all day long. He is not scared at all of fastballs in the zone. And yes, it's backed up by like an unbelievable splitter, which is quite an equalizer. Mitch White has a really good slider. You know, it just moves in another direction from the splitter. That can be his backup pitch. That can be his equalizer if he's locating that for strikes, or at least making it look like more of a strike. That's going to help his fastball play up. So I think that it's really just a mentality thing for Mitch White, and just being in that attack mindset with two strikes, not getting into those deep battles. And that's something that I know he actually talked to Kevin Gausman about after that start, the day that he got optioned. Him and Kevin Gausman had a very long conversation in the Blue Jays dugout and in the outfield as well. And they went through some things with some lanes and target setting. You know, Mitch White's been a guy who's typically set his target on the glove. And with Alejandro Kirk behind the plate, you'll notice this. Oftentimes he'll set the glove and then he'll drop it. And then I think for Mitch White, a lot of time he's like, oh, wait, where'd my target go? My target's gone. So a little tweak there is setting your target on the shin pad, or setting your target on like the face mask. Those are some of the little things I think that Kevin Gausman was trying to share. And some of the things I think Mitch White can benefit from now is just changing the mentality and making some little tweaks to be on the plate more in those two strike counts and to be more aggressive before some of the bigger adjustments that are going to come next spring.
Yeah. And to me, that's interesting stuff. And it kind of sounds like a pitcher who's a work in progress. And this is not the time of year in September to take big leaps of faith on works in progress. You want finished products. You want guys who give you results right now. And unfortunately, in the case of White, that doesn't seem to be where he's at.
Bullpen. Julian Merriweather. Level of confidence right now. Are you throwing him in leverage?
Right now, no. But my level of confidence, I would say, is to be determined, which is probably better than low. It's better than just, you know, a clear, yeah, there's not confidence here. I'd say it's just uncertainty. I'm not sure what he can offer. I haven't seen enough of him. And I think that the answer clearly will reveal itself in the next couple of weeks. To me, you start up in low leverage, continue easing him in to the extent that that's possible, and go from there in the hopes that he can get to that point, knowing that he has the stuff to certainly be a high leverage option if needed. But I mean, do you see that differently at this point? Have you reached an answer for Merriweather?
I think you want to give him some runway just to find his feet. He's pitching at the big league level for the first time in a while. Obviously had the physical issues earlier this year, so you want to give him a little bit of time. I think the biggest thing with him is like the fastball can't be over the heart of the plate. like, because it doesn't move a lot, his fastball. And like, that's okay. If you're 97 to 99, it doesn't move a lot. That's okay. You just got to be to the edges, or you got to be like to the very top or very bottom. Like, you got to be around the edges of the strike zone. When you're over the heart, big league hitters are too good now. They see this type of velocity all the time, and they can turn it around. Guys turn around Felix Bautista. The freaking Bo Bichette walked up to the plate and turned around Felix Bautista at Camden Yards. He got to first base. Ryan Mountcastle was laughing at him, just like, how did you do that? You're the most locked in dude on the planet right now. Hitters like, you know, Brian Baker, right? Like, Teoscar Hernandez turned him around. Like, it's just, Baker's throwing hard, right? So, you know, 97, 99, like, as weird as it is, like, isn't that exceptional anymore in the big league level? So now for Merriweather, is just going to be commanding it and location, because I don't think he's going to learn to add cut or sink or run or ride to his fastball in the next 4 weeks,
which is fine. And yeah, I think the command is a little unpredictable at this point, just with the amount of time that he's missed. You see that sometimes with Tommy John guys, where the command takes a little bit more time to come back than the velocity, or even than the pure stuff, like the break on the pitches, for example. And so for both Pearson, Nate Pearson, who's now been promoted, I guess you could say, to AAA Buffalo as he tries to make his return. But for both Pearson and for Merriweather, they've missed so much time that the reps aren't there. And so the command, I think, is a real variable, not something to be taken for granted. And that's where, to me, both those guys, but, you know, especially Merriweather, because he's the one who's actually on the major league team, these guys are uncertain. It's hard to place where that confidence level is.
Let's take a quick Pearson diversion, since we're here. Level of confidence in Nate Pearson contributing for the Toronto Blue Jays this year?
I gotta say, low.
Yeah.
Depending on what you mean by contributing. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he pitches for them at some point. Contributing, though, I mean, I think it's got to be low. It's just, at this point, he's got to show me something before I can say I have any confidence in Nate Pearson. I'm intrigued. My eyes are open. I'll be watching. I'm not writing anyone off, but do I have confidence? No.
He's going to have to go to Buffalo and absolutely break the door down to the big leagues. Like, I think it's possible. He's that talented and he's that good. Sure. And his stuff is that exceptional, but he's going to have to go and like put up an absurd strikeout rate, tons of swinging strikes, not be walking anybody, location, command, poise on the mound, confidence, bouncing back strong in between outings. Like, he is going to have to nail everything, and then the Blue Jays in turn are going to have a need in their bullpen. Like, that's like those are the circumstances that we're looking at right now for Nate Pearson to contribute to this team. So I'm honestly not expecting it until I've seen Nate Pearson just blowing the doors off in Buffalo. Yep. I think really he's just like getting some innings right now, and he's just sort of building back up for what will likely be a busy winter of pitching. And that could be the Arizona Fall League, that could be the Caribbean, that could be Australia. I mean, there's, you know, some differing opinions right now, I think, on like what environment would be best for Nate Pearson. But Nate Pearson is going to be in games this winter because he just needs them. He hasn't had enough reps over the last couple of years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's the mental side of it, there's the physical side of it, there's the command, there's reading swings, all the developmental opportunities, I guess you could say. He just hasn't had them. So now's the time.
Yeah. And you can like put him on a mound in Dunedin or put him in a pitching lab somewhere. He's had plenty of that over the last couple of years. What he needs is to be in games, to be facing competition and learning how to make adjustments in games and what to do when he doesn't have this during an outing or doesn't have that. Like, he just needs that experience. So that's really going to be the offseason task for Nate Pearson. Behind the plate, Alejandro Kirk, Danny Jansen. Where's the confidence level at? Where's the playing time going to be at going forward? How do you see this breaking down? Because we saw Alejandro Kirk in that Orioles series start 3 days in a row behind the plate. Hadn't seen him do that yet to this point in the season.
That's right. 3 days in a row. So that is a big ask of Alejandro Kirk with an off day Thursday. I mean, the way Kirk has hit, and he continues to hit, still more walks than strikeouts, average around 300, just a tremendous offensive season. And one that, you know, again, not to pick on anyone here, but say Santiago Espinal, also a first-time All-Star this year, Santiago Espinal has really fallen off offensively. Alejandro Kirk, in contrast to that, has really provided the Blue Jays and anyone else watching with more reason to believe that what he's doing is sustainable. And so that applies in the short term as well as the long term. And so as the Blue Jays play this stretch of games that's incredibly meaningful, of course you're going to find ways to get Danny Jansen in there. I'm sure Jansen will start at least a third, maybe two out of every five behind the plate. And then you have Kirk catching potentially 3 of 5 and DHing one of those other five. All of a sudden you have him in the lineup most days, which you really want because he's so important to you offensively. So I think there are ways to get Jansen in there 2 to 3 times out of every five. Then he's playing 4 or 5 times a week, staying fresh. And yeah, Kirk is probably the one who shoulders a bit more of the load.
Sample size of 0 plate appearances. Who is the Blue Jays leader in weighted runs created plus this season?
Sample size of 0. Okay.
Literally everybody. Anybody who's made a plate appearance. Who is the Toronto Blue Jays leader in weighted runs created plus this season?
Man.
You don't have to think that hard about it.
Is it Kirk?
It's Alejandro Kirk.
And a drive to deep left field. 3-run home run for Alejandro Kirk.
But it's a big one. His 13th, lucky 13th.
As we sit here today, Thursday, September 8th, it's Alejandro Kirk.
Wow.
141. Wow. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is in second at 133. That's all you need to
know. I mean, you think about that, right? Like George Springer is on this team. Bo Bichette's on this team. Vladdy's on this team. Chapman. Alejandro Kirk is the guy who has been the best. And again, that's not taking in position. That's taking in league. That's taking in ballpark. That's not giving him a positional adjustment. So just straight up hitter to hitter, he's been their best hitter.
Yep, in 462 plate appearances, Alejandro Kirk, 141 weighted runs created plus. That's why he's going to see the lion's share of play behind the plate down the stretch, because Danny Jansen is not hitting like that. Nobody on the team is hitting like that. But the Blue Jays are making decisions now where they are prioritizing getting Kirk's bat in the lineup because it just has been that good, because it just has been that potent throughout the season, and it's just bringing so much. And even when he's had these sort of little power slumps that we've seen from him, he's still getting on base and he's still making contact. He's still working deep plate appearances. I mean, he's still seeing pitches well. He's still contributing and having productive plate appearances. So I just think that the reality right now for the Blue Jays is, will we take a little bit of a hit defensively sometimes to get Kirk's in the bat in the lineup? Yes, because we feel that's more optimal. But it's also a credit to Kirk and how far his defense has come. He frames so well at the bottom of the zone. It was another, there were like so many other storylines I didn't get to from the Orioles series, one of them being the Orioles changing their starting pitcher in game 2 of the doubleheader, letting the Blue Jays know about it 4 minutes before first pitch in the meeting at the plate. Are you kidding me? But another one was Kirk catching Gausman, because he just vacuumed up pitches into the zone. Oh my goodness, was he good for Kevin Gausman in that Gausman outing. You see it with Manoa as well. I mean, his framing is exceptional, and I think he's gotten better at some of the other defensive aspects behind the plate as well. He's always going to clog up your base pass. He's never going to be like he's always going to be a station-to-station guy on the bases, but I think that he has improved a lot defensively to a point where the Blue Jays feel really comfortable with him as kind of their everyday starting catcher in a low-key way right now, and I think that's what we're going to see down the stretch.
Yeah, and the balancing act there, of course, is you can't have him wear out in 3 weeks' time, or in, you know, they want to win the World Series, right? That's what they state as their goal. So that's 7 weeks from now. You can't have him wearing out then. But of course, really, you have to have him fresh for the playoffs. And then you just push at that point. You push with everything you have. So there's still a little bit of that balancing act right now where you still have to get Jansen in some of the time. Whereas in the playoffs, it's possible Kirk starts like most of the game, like almost all of the games, depending on how the off days line up and the scheduling and day after night and so on. But yeah, he's such a good player. And, you know, to the offensive points about him, I mean, you can look at the numbers in various ways and point out his amazing bat to ball skills and the emerging power. But one of the things for me just watching the games is there's no bad matchup. Like there's never a pitcher, a starting pitcher, a reliever. You're never like, oh, but Kirk can't get to this guy, because Kirk can kind of get to everyone when he's on.
Yeah. Final one. And this is actually going to be 3 players in one, but sort of related to what we're talking about and just the dispersion of playing time now and the way those decisions are being made differently. Whit Merrifield, Santiago Espinal, who you mentioned,
Cavan Biggio. Like, think about these three guys, right? You mentioned Espinal, a literal all-star, playing in the all-star game like 7 weeks ago, had like an OPS up over 800 at one point this season. He started 20 of the Blue Jays' last 34 games since the beginning of August, part-time player for the last, you know, month and change. Cavan Biggio, right? A guy who like lost his job to Espinal early this season. He's on COVID IL for a while. He was in the minors for like 2 weeks, came back. He was playing first. He was playing corner outfield. Now all of a sudden you're seeing him get more run at second base, and you're seeing him in the lineup like just as often as Santiago Espinal is. Over that same sample since the beginning of August, Biggio's had 17 starts to Espinal's 20th. That's been much more of a timeshare. Whit Merrifield, who was like as close to Cal Ripken as anybody gets these days, right? Played every day, literally every single game for the Kansas City Royals for like 5 years, led MLB in games played from 2018 through to the point that he was traded to the Blue Jays this season. Ross Atkins called him an everyday player at the deadline, had more hits than anybody in baseball since 2018 at the time. He started 9 of Toronto's last 22. What do you make of the playing time between these three, the confidence level in with these three? How should John Schneider be using them going forward?
Well, I think the first two, Espinal and Biggio, deserve the starts. And I think that they can effectively be used in that platoon. Biggio maybe plays a little bit of corner outfield or first base as needed. Espinal, you know, if Chapman or Bo needs a day, he's the guy to slide over there. And so I think that's a platoon that works reasonably well for the Blue Jays. I don't think you need to mess it up. I don't think Whit Merrifield, based on the offensive production that we're seeing from him, deserves to be in that conversation as a starter right now. I think he is someone who provides you versatility. I think he's a nice 26th, at this point 28th man on the roster to potentially slide around, do different things, give you good base running if you need it. You're not scared to start him. He's totally fine if you need to start him at certain points, but I don't think you're going out of your way to find starts for Whit Merrifield simply because you look at the offensive production this year and we got a big enough sample and the results are pretty clearly well below average. And so you have better options. So use them.
Merrifield's a classic guy where if it was like June, July, it would be, oh, he just needs some more runway to come out of it because there's a track record there over the course of his career. It's a bunch of batted ball and expected statistics that suggest like he's deserved better. You know, the strikeout rate with the Blue Jays is way, way inflated from where it's been in his career, and the contact rate's been way lower. So like you would expect those things to come back around. I can't imagine there's been just a cliff with his batted ball ability that he has suddenly dropped off of. There's a lot of signs there that if you give him the runway and you give him the time, he would come out of this and play better. This time of the year, you can't do that, though. This time of the year, you have to overreact to cold streaks. Like, you have to act quicker to take players who are cold out of the lineup and to ride hot streaks. So if Cavan Biggio is on, like, sneaky a little bit of a hot streak right now, I wouldn't call it like a dramatic like Bo Bichette style hot streak, but since he came back in May, I mean, like, he's been pretty solid, Cavan Biggio has. So I think you would ride that a bit more. It's the same thing with Espinal, right? Pretty cold since the all-star break. That's why he's been seeding starts to Cavan Biggio. I mean, you know, it's really a dynamic daily decision for John Schneider right now with who gets into his lineup. And I think he's, you know, rating that recent performance. He's considering matchups, track records. He's thinking about how each player profiles offensively and how that fits in his batting order. If you've got that line of really aggressive right-handers, it is kind of nice to put Cavan Biggio's left-handed bat in there and just like his different approach at the plate in there, so that an opposing starter can't fall into that rhythm of like, here's how I'm attacking you, and I attack you the same way, and you the same way, and you the same way. It's all of a sudden, okay, here's the left-handed hitter who's a bit more discerning and a bit more patient and takes more pitches. It kind of breaks you out of that rhythm and gives you something else to think about. And I think you've seen that impact that he can have when he's hitting seventh and eighth and kind of bringing that before that run of aggressive righty starts up again at the top of the lineup. I think you're considering defense. I think you're considering, you know, who's on the mound, base running.
I think that every night, like, John Schneider's kind of making that dynamic decision about who's going to give the Blue Jays the best chance to win on this night in these circumstances against that starter in this ballpark with this pitcher on the mound for us, etc. And I think that the really good thing that John Schneider's done is he's communicated that directly to each player and he has reinforced it. Like, it wasn't just a one-time conversation at the beginning of August. It's like a daily thing of like telling those guys, here's why we're making those decisions. Like, here's why your playing time is what it is. Like, it's kind of an underrated thing about John Schneider, and a bit of a difference between him and the guy that he replaced is that he is really communicative with his players, and his players know exactly why decisions are being made. They know exactly where they stand. And I think that makes it a lot easier for those pitchers to buy into role changes when you're talking about an all-star becoming a part-time player, or like an Iron Man everyday starter for 5 years becoming a guy who really isn't starting very much at all.
Yeah, for sure. All those things definitely make a difference for those, for everyone involved. You know, to the points on Merrifield too, I think some of it is, you know, you just look at those indicators, right? Beyond the batting average, beyond the OPS, and you see the barrel rate that's just a bit down. You see the expected weighted on base, that's pretty low. The strikeout rate is a little bit up. You know, he still doesn't strike out a ton, but this is someone who's expected and advanced numbers are not particularly good either. So there's just nothing really to recommend him taking those starts. And I'm sure John Schneider would find a better way to phrase it than that when he's talking to Whit Merrifield. But ultimately, you know, it's clear that his results all season long and the process that's led to those results has not been great. So right now he's more in that supplemental role. We'll see where that leads for him and for the Jays.
I take your point. I, you know, mine would be more so that like his expected batting average, his expected slugging, his expected weighted on base are all higher than the actual numbers. They aren't the expected numbers aren't fantastic, right? Like the expected numbers, even if he reached those, wouldn't be that of somebody who's going to carry your offense. But the fact that they are all better than the actual numbers, like, tells me he has been unfortunate and there is room for him to perform better. But like, look, it's September. Like, it's stretch run, postseason push. You're playing the teams you're directly competing against in a playoff race. If Whit Merrifield isn't being productive and isn't giving you great plate appearances, like, you have to diminish his playing time, and he's okay with that. Like, he understands that, and he has been a total team player about it and a total professional about it. If you ask anybody in that clubhouse, like, he hasn't been complaining about it. And sort of the other thing to note with Biggio that I just quickly looked up, since he came back from the minors in late May, he's hit 245, 335, 446, nearly a 14% walk rate. Some consistency from Kevin Biggio. Again, not carrying your lineup with those numbers by any means, but absolutely like giving you something from the 7-8 position in your order when you also layer in the defensive versatility as well.
If the Jays get this from Kevin Biggio for the rest of his career, I think they're thrilled. I think they keep him. I think that you keep him through his arb years at that point. Like, that's a really good player. It's a really useful contributor on a lot of fronts. And yeah, I mean, Kevin Biggio has really emerged and really reasserted himself as someone who, yeah, I'm not going to say he's part of this team's core per se, not when you have Springer and Bo and Vladdy and Manoah around, but he's someone who's an important contributor to this team.
We truly could have done like a 3-hour podcast today because we talked about all that stuff and we didn't get to like Alek Manoah, who had this unbelievable outing on Wednesday. Yep. Bo Bichette, who's been like surface
Jordan
level.
Romano.
The Sun Hot. George Springer, who we talked about every day for the entire summer and now don't talk about anymore. Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who's having this fascinating season and whose ground ball rates are like through the roof right now and whose swing decisions are pretty alarming. Matt Chapman, who like has just been the model of consistency and taken on like a massive role with this team in terms of leadership of late. We didn't talk about any of those guys.
Yeah.
It's pretty incredible.
We should at least give Bo Bichette a little shout out because, you know, that's been quite a turnaround for him. And I think it reinforces to me where Bo Bichette's floor is, because we saw that for most of the year and he was still around league average as a hitter, playing one of the most demanding defensive positions, doing it every day on a contending team. None of those things are easy. Then he goes off for 10 days. Now you look up at the shortstop offensive leaderboards, Xander Bogaerts, Trey Turner, Corey Seager, Bo Bichette, right there. So to me, he deserves a quick shout out, if nothing else, on ATL for one of the hottest weeks we've probably ever seen from a Blue Jays player in 2022.
Remember when we were in the Bronx and we did the thing about, you know, what's one Blue Jay that they need more from over the rest of the season, right? And I think you said Berríos, I want to say.
How's that right? Going?
I'm not great. Sure. mixed returns. Mine was Bo Bichette, who was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I'll do that. Right. And I think, and my point was like, look, he's only had one hot streak all season. We know you can go on crazy heaters. Like, we know you can go on insane runs. And that's exactly what he's done here. He's never going to be happy with his 2022 at the end of the year. I promise you, he's not going to be happy with the line on his Fangraphs page. He hasn't been happy with his performance all year, even when he hits three home runs in a game. He doesn't look that happy about it, right?
He's still got 4 weeks left in the playoffs, so who knows?
Do you truly think Bo Bichette's going to get to the end of this year and be happy with how it went?
If the Jays win the World Series, he will.
Yes, okay.
They're a long way from that.
Right. If they don't win the World Series, or taking out team result, separate team result. Right. When Bo Bichette thinks just about individual results in 2022, I promise you, he's not going to be happy. No. He's insanely self-critical, and I relate to that in a way that nobody's ever going to understand. But like, he's just not going to be happy with what he did in 2022, and he's going to do a lot of searching for things in the offseason, and he's going to do a lot of things to try to correct that going into next year and to be better. But what he can focus on right now, doing right now, is playing closer to his potential as he has, which can be a huge leverage point for this lineup, can make a massive difference. Could you imagine if you got Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. playing to their potential for the next 4 weeks? This team will skate into the postseason. It'll be a cakewalk.
Without a doubt.
Forget just that Orioles series at the end being irrelevant. It would be the Red Sox one before it as well. Like, it would be maybe taking down the Yankees for the division if those two guys play up to their potential over the rest of the season. One of them has been for a week. We'll see if the other guy can too.
This makes me wonder, what's the Arden's Welling equivalent of a three home run game? And did we just see it in Baltimore, or is that like, you know, a day where you do like two TV hits and a podcast, or what's the equivalent?
I don't know. I don't know what to say off of that wouldn't be just soul crushing and depressing, and not a way anybody wants to leave a podcast. He's Ben Nicholson Smith. I'm Arden Zwelling. We're going to be with you throughout the rest of the season and what is going to be a fascinating end to the Blue Jays run in 2022. I want to thank Luis Ramirez and Christian Ryan for their production this week, and want to thank all you for listening. Talk to you next week on At the Letters.